This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books in African Studies, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Elisa Prosperetti. Achimata School is one of Ghana's most well-known secondary schools. Opened in 1927, Achimota was the fruit of a particular moment in Gold Coast history. It was a unique institution built as a model colonial secondary school that was meant to combine the very best in British and African tradition. Instead, what really happened at Achimota, says our guest today, was the creation of a new culture all its own. Today we are speaking with Shoko Yamada about her 2018 book, Dignity of Labor for African Leaders, The Formation of Education Policy in the British Colonial Office and Achimota School on the Gold Coast. Shoko is a professor of comparative education and African studies at the Graduate School of International Development of Nagoya University in Japan. Shoko Yamada, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much.
So let's begin at the beginning. In the 90s, before you started your dissertation on which this book is based, you were working in the development policy space. So how did you get involved in that and what was that landscape like?
Okay. Well, in the 1990s, I was working as a specialist of international education development in a consultant firm. And during that time, in 1990, there was a big international conference called Education for All International Development Conference that was held in Jomtien, Thailand. And more than 200 national representatives and international organizations have attended and signed unanimously and six international goals in the field of education were agreed. And one of them, the primary goal of it, was to make primary education universally accessible for all children around the world. Then what does it mean for the people working in the field of international development? They started to establish schools in countries which didn't have high enrollment rate in the primary school. So that brought me to many African countries as an expert of education. Then I was very young, 25 or 26, but I went to many countries and each time I went there, I interviewed local community members. What is the issue of education in your community? But they are already informed that if they answer the interview of me in a very successful way, they will get schools. So that's why they always say that school is a need. School is necessary. We need the school and teachers for our children. It was almost like unanimous voices. And then I started to feel that this is something wrong. You know, the aid projects may be very important thing, and that rights of education is important thing for children, of course. But at the same time, there are so big population in the countries I visit who haven't attended school in the parents' generation. And the school education is not so common practices at that time. Then what is the meaning of education for them? Do they send their children for the sake of knowledge? Or do they want school for the promotion or for the urban life or for cash income? I didn't understand why people are so much rushing to the school construction. Then one morning when I was in Guinea, I woke up in the hotel and then I felt that this is not something I want to do. I don't want to correct the unanimous voices of the villagers, so-called villagers' voices, which is somehow percolated by the politics of international education development. I really want to look into the history of education in this community, how school started in this country and in this society. The school history was not long anyway, because there is a long tradition of oral transmission of knowledge. So the institutionalized school itself is a colonial product. So that's why I thought that now I want to understand the meaning of knowledge in this community, in this society in Africa. Then to understand that, the first thing I need to do is to know how school education started here and what is the difference of sending children to school and learning knowledge in the community.
Well, as a trained historian, I can only wish that many, many, many more people working in the space of development ask themselves those series of questions. How did these institutions emerge, and what are their legacies? So you're interested in this question of the history of schooling in order to really better grasp what you're seeing in your own work in the contemporary development space, and you go to Indiana University.
Yes.
So what was the topic of your dissertation? How did you come to it?
Well, originally I was not very sure exactly what kind of topic I wanted, but I knew that I want to write something about education in West Africa, because West Africa was the most frequent site for me to work before going to the PhD program. So without having any particular idea about dissertation research project, anyway, I decided to go to Ghana for looking for some ideas of dissertation project. And I went to the library of University of Ghana. And then that library had some collections of books about the history of education in Africa and Ghana. Well, the collection was not very new, but for older history, there were more information at that time. Then I encountered one book about Gugisberg, the Governor Gugisberg, and how he contributed the education of the Ghanaian population during the colonial time. So that encounter was the starting point for me to make it my dissertation project.
For anyone who knows Ghana, to be reading a text of Gugisberg in the Balm Library of Lagan, thinking about Achimota, it's almost like the, you know, kind of colonial, post-colonial trifecta of higher education.
Right.
Okay, so we have this topic and your kind of, you know, unique perspective and approach to this topic. And you defend your dissertation in 2003. But the book that we're talking about, The Dignity of Labor for African Leaders, it comes out only in 2018.
Yes, it took a long time. Well, of course, I had some wish of publishing it as a book right after defending my dissertation. But, well, publishing a historiography of Africa is not very easy. The market is not very big. So, and right after the dissertation, I had to go back to Japan. My scholarship expired. Well, actually, half a year before the submission of dissertation, actually, the scholarship was ended. So I survived with a saving. And as soon as I got the degree, I had to start looking for a job. Then the easiest place for me to look for a job was to come back to Japan. So I started to work as a postdoc scholar in Hiroshima University. That was the first job after PhD. And when I was looking for a job and asking for advice from people, somebody told me that, oh, you chose history of Africa for your dissertation topic. That might be academic suicide, you know? It's not going to lead you anywhere. You know, in Japan, very few people might be interested in history and Africa, you know, the combination of these two words of Africa and history, that is not going to lead you anywhere. That was something I was told.
And well, also, I will interrupt you to say, mm-hmm. our audience is here to prove otherwise. The combination of Africa and history is very, very interesting.
Yes.
To thousands of people.
Right. Yeah. After many years, I have met many interesting people, scholars who are interested in the history of colonial education in Africa. So I don't think the advice I got at that time was correct. But anyway, I was desperate to find a job. And then so I felt that for the time being, I should stop doing history. That was the decision I made in 2003. Another thing I felt was that then if I stop pursuing history, however much it is interesting, then let's reflect on the original cause of myself to have gone to the PhD program. That was the day, the morning in Guinea that I was working as a development expert, but I was not happy with that framework of work, and I wanted to dig the deeper questions so that we can make sense of the contemporary developmental issues more clearly and critically. So to be able to do that, then I have to demonstrate audiences that what I'm doing is relevant to what they are interested in. So that's how I shifted rather drastically for other people's view to the contemporary issues, but with the hope that one day people would know that what I have been saying about history is fundamentally relevant to what I'm writing about the contemporary issues. So that made the historical study in my dissertation to be a lifelong project for me.
Fantastic. And so this will kind of help realize this goal. So I'm delighted that we're able to have this conversation. So your book is about, let's say, two maybe major touchstones. One is the memorandum, the famous memorandum from 1925 of the Tropical Advisory Committee on Education in Africa or in British Africa. And the other is the opening and then the initial experience of Achimota School a few years later in 1927. Right. Before we talk about these two maybe pillars of your book and of the period, maybe you want to give us a sense of the immediate post-World War I context, the early 1920s, and I think an event that really ties these two together is the Phelps-Stokes Commission, which sends so-called experts to West Africa to do a survey of African educational needs and to think about what education should look like. This is a commission, the Phelps-Stokes Commission, that has received a tremendous amount of attention, and rightly so, because it's a pretty fascinating case. I wonder if you could give us a sense of it and what you think was its principal impact in setting up the memorandum on the one hand and Achimota on the other.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The Phelps-Stokes Commission was the final act of the interactions between the British missionary commissions and also the colonial office of the British government and other stakeholders in the Britain, and on the one hand, and on the other hand, the American the foundations and philanthropies who wanted to promote the model of education they developed in southern part of America. So there is a kind of coincidence of interest from the side of the British. They needed some externally proved effective methods of handling the interracial issues. If they apply the models they developed within the British the empire, then there will be a lot of resistance from the colonial subjects, because they would say that if British brings the education model for the working class in the UK, then they would, the Africans would say, oh, you are bringing the inferior education for working class. We are not the working class. We are the very highly prouded African leaders. So that kind of transplantation doesn't work. And so, but still they wanted to handle the racial issues. So that's how the British wanted to borrow the model from elsewhere, completely away from the British Empire. At the same time, Americans had the domestic challenge. They also wanted to, you know, handle the black populations under the control of the white population. And then they developed this education model of vocational education for Africa, the black people, freed laborers, former slaves, to accept the value of dignity of work. You know, the working labor work is not the inferior thing. The black people should internalize the pride of being laborer. So that kind of vocational education model, not only to train the hand skill, but also the mentality to accept being a laborer. That was the kind of education model which was developed by the philanthropies and those people involved in the black education at that time. But that kind of models were criticized very much in the movement of African human the black human rights movement. So then the Americans also needed to externalize the evaluation of the black education model to say that, oh, those British people appreciate our black education model so highly, and by adopting our black education model in Africa, they successfully manage the interracial issues. So that's how their interest converged, and that negotiation has been actually going on at various levels. There are a lot of letters and exchanges and the record of conversations and those kind of things between people who want to promote American black education model and people on the other side of the ocean who wants to get some idea from safely distant place. Then at the very end of that negotiation process, the Phelps-Stokes Commission was dispatched. That's how, so the Phelps-Stokes Commission is very symbolic, and their report was cited so frequently, but actually the storyline of Phelps-Stokes Commission's report was already sprinkled everywhere in the documents published by the British Colonial Office or the Missionary Committee, councils, and all kinds of documents have already mentioned about the similar kind of things, which is written in the Phelps-Stokes report. So that's the, you know, somehow the interactions of actors and mutual enforcement of words and ideas and the reference from one document to another and still another document. That's how the discourse was formulated.
I think this is really a contribution that you bring in your book to show how these different approaches to, maybe approaches to education is the right way to say it, but these different interest groups in promoting and fashioning colonial education tried to use each other to legitimize the discourse. And what they legitimized between each other, and we're about to get to you know, nationalist critique and resistance, of course, of this discourse. But what they legitimized was this very broad and very slippery term, adapted education. And you kind of unpack this term, adapted education, which means everything and nothing, of course. And you try to isolate the different strands of both reactionary and progressive thinking that are folded into this term. So on the one hand, you have progressive John Dewey education for democracy. And on the other hand, we have the Booker T. Washington Hampton model, which was, as you just pointed out, fashioned around an idea of accepting manual labor as being the condition of education, which was a site of strong resistance by people like W.B. Du Bois and others. So maybe if you could tease apart for us these three, well, we just talked about the industrial education model in the U.S. South, but maybe how the progressive idea of John Dewey's education model feeds into adaptive education. On the other hand, the kind of British Victorian moralism, which is part of that, and how it affects also girls and women.
That's a very interesting point. The common key idea, which transcend across very different educational ideas, was the experientialism. The people would learn through experience. That is a common basis of different educational ideas of that time. So for example, the Booker T. Washington's industrial education model, that one also says that the learners, Black learners, would internalize the value of labor manual work by through the experience of doing that manual work. That is the experientialist explanation of manual work. On the other hand, John Dewey, as many of the listeners must know, he promoted the idea of learning by doing. You know, people, the children or learners will be put in the environment in which he or she can explore something attractive for him or her, and then, you know, explore by himself or herself, and then extend the interest, motivations of continuous learning. And then along that line, those learners themselves would learn how to live in the society in a coherent manner and in a democratic way. You know, you need to value other people's interest also while you are going to pursue your own interest. So So the experientialism of John Dewey is considered to be very liberal idea, but in the sense that it promotes learning by doing, it was convenient catchword for those people who wants to promote Booker T. Washington's industrial education model to Africa. Then the British education, particularly those ideas of educating leaders in the public schools, that was also exported to the leadership education in the school like Achimota in British colonies. So that was also the model of education which promote participation in a team sport and living in the common dormitory together with other students and self-governance of students board, you know, those kind of things are learned through the experience so that the students will become a very committed member of the society and contribute to the cause of the society and lead the people. Not only for his own sake, but for the whole society. So these things, that the target population actually are very different. One industrial education model was for Black people to be subordinate. And John Dewey's experientialism is more for liberal education. And the British public school model was for the leadership training for the British Empire, officials. Still, all of them share the same idea of learning by doing. And by having that convenient common keyword, that common keyword becomes something like a revolving door. Somehow, once you pass through that revolving door, you can conveniently connect the educational idea, which if you ask very carefully, they are completely opposite idea of education. One is to make people subordinate, another is to liberate them, but by going through that revolving door of learning by doing, all these different educational ideas were presented as if they are seamlessly linked and logically connected. That's how these diverse educational ideas are mingled and cooked together to be made as educational model for African leaders.
I really find this aspect of your work so well done, because I think that it's very easy to say, of course, in a colonial context, all of these distinctions between different types of oppression or of supposed liberatory practices, they really all resemble each other because it's still part of the project of colonial domination and colonial supremacy. But what's more difficult, I think, is to tease out the different intellectual genesis of the way that these ideas come together to form this really effective, basically mega gaslight of the entire colonial structure. And giving us those terms and that precision, I really think is one of the great contributions of this book.
Thank you so much.
So we have these strands coming together, and maybe we'll move to thinking a little bit more about the Gold Coast context in particular, because what the memorandum does is it sets this kind of empire-wide framework, and then that empire-wide framework is translated in each colonial setting. And we have lots of different actors in education in the Gold Coast. We have the British colonial administration, we have missionaries, we have a African nationalist elite, we can call it that way. And then we have a more traditional, perhaps, elite, as you talk about, among African stakeholders. And so you identify these four groups and their discussions about what education should be in mid-1920s Gold Coast. So when we look at kind of that landscape, what do you see as the perspective of the African stakeholders as they're hearing these discourses and seeing the Phelps-Stokes Commission come? How do you see this varied reaction?
Mm-hmm. One of the difficulties of African historiography is that it is difficult to get the ordinary people's voices because they are not recorded. They don't write their own diaries or anything. So what I have relied on as a data to get the perspective of African people was a newspaper. So apparently those people who write on the newspapers are intellectuals, highly educated, and most of them went to the British universities and became a lawyer or whatever. Those people became the leaders of the independent movement. So their perspective as intellectual leaders were trying to believe that Achimota school is going to be liberating and empowering African intellectuals. So that was the African intellectual perspective. I looked at the report which was submitted to the council in the Gold Coast colony. And that was a collection of interviews with the African leaders. Some of them are nationalist leaders, others were the traditional chiefs. And the traditional chiefs, they didn't want their young people to lose tradition or to forget about the histories of African way of living. But the nationalist leaders, they, of course, they also share the same view that the Africans shouldn't forget about the history and forget about their tradition. That's the same. But the nationalists tend to have more stronger desire that the education in Achimota should be of the same quality as the British public schools. So they thought that teaching African tradition is fine, but most important thing is to teach Latin or the literature or those kind of things, which may not directly relate to the lives of people in Africa, but still important to be of equal level as the British. So that's a bit of different nuance of good education between the traditional chiefs and nationalists. But all in all, they rejected the idea of giving the second class education for Africans.
Right, and I believe James Agri is very famous for saying only the best is good enough for Africa. I wonder if, I've read some of these newspapers too of this time and read some of these debates and discussions. And one thing that always strikes me to really show, on the one hand, we just, mentioned that we have the British and the Americans kind of speaking to each other in this trans-imperial way. But we have the Gold Coast intellectuals and nationalists looking outside the Western world for their educational inspirations, and the recurrence of the idea of Meiji Japan and the idea of Meiji Restoration from the mid to late 19th century onwards is such a powerful inspiration for Kobunosuchi and others. When you were reading this as a Japanese, did you kind of think about these parallels and a different perspective on this binary between Western European education and Africanized education?
Oh, that's an interesting question.
It always strikes me how globalized the Gold Coast elite is.
Yeah, that's true.
To call it simply nationalist really flattens the kind of global perspective that they have.
Okay. One thing which I think interesting Even though the nationalist intellectuals were so much informed of the news in Asia, you know, Japan-Russia war, all kinds of things are reported in the newspaper, and they praise the Japanese as yellow people combated against the Russian and beat them, and they praise the Japanese is the pride, you know, the symbol of the possibilities of colored people, how much the colored people can actually do. So that kind of reference was very interesting. And at the same time, I felt that it is a bit strange to see those African intellectuals trusted the Agri, James Agri, who was a member of the Phelps-Stokes Commission, and who was almost like a mouthpiece of what the Phelps-Stokes Commission was going to say. And African leaders trusted in James Agri's words so much, even though it is actually the same thing which is promoted by the Phelps-Stokes Foundation Commission, and that is actually the intention of the British colonial government. Agri was symbolically accepted as the person, figure, who grew up in a small community in Gold Coast and was sent to America and succeeded and got the degree there and came back here to Africa to provide something very good for African people. They didn't question about that. So that is a kind of interesting thing I observed, that and that was successful from the side of the British and American. Using Agri was very powerful. Well, I'm sorry, I may have skewed away from your question, but that's something which was reminded to me.
Agri persists as an enigma. He's also tremendously charismatic and effective person, so it's always hard to know. But the argument begins to be how to Africanize Achimota so that Achimota is going to be the best of these both worlds. And so how do the British and the Africans who are collaborating with them on this project think about Africanization, but then what is really the kind of result of this hybrid approach?
One thing is very practical issue. The money was running out. You know, during the interwar period, you know, that's a very happy coincidence of the time when the Gugisberg, very visionary governor, was in Gold Coast. The economy of Gold Coast was very good also, you know, exporting the minerals to Europe during the interwar period was very highly demanded, and the price of gold and price of minerals has risen up very quickly. So the income of the Gold Coast colony was very high. So that was a very happy coincidence. But the situation, economic situation in Europe, the metropole, was also declining. And then the war was about to start. The Second World War was about to start. And when the metropole situation becomes worse, then the colonial economy is also influenced too. So the Achimota School started as a gigantic project, and many ideas were exchanged about how to combine the high quality Western education with the pride of African tradition. Now, all these nice discussions actually was reflected to the practice only for the first few years. And after that, you know, those statements were there. Always the school principals and teachers mentioned about those happy marriage of Western and African culture. But in reality, The budget for Achimota was decreasing very sharply, and then the practice of ideal leadership education was only for the first few years. But then, as you kindly mentioned at the beginning of this interview, the melange of culture created the new type of people who became the leader of independent Ghana. So that was kind of unexpected, but still different ways of cultivating the leadership in the newly independent country.
So let's talk about girls, because Achimota was the first secondary school in the Gold Coast that was co-educational. Mm. The other two were only for boys at the time. Mm. And your book kind of teases out these distinctions of race, class, and gender in these educational discourses. So how did Achimota imagine the role of girls in its educational process at the intersection mm-hmm. of these British and African traditions?
Mm-hmm. That's very interesting. The Achimota tried to cultivate good wives of leading class in Africa. That's a very strange complication. You know, they try to handle the interracial issue by establishing the school to cultivate obedient African leaders. But in that sense, there is a racial consideration in the whole project of Achimota School. But at the same time, within the school, they try to cultivate the leaders, which is similar in some sense to the counterpart of British elites. So then the wives of these leaders of the nation has to be also trained in the very Victorian kind of female domestic supporter of the leader of the country. So those women who went to the early days of Achimota, they told me, you know, I interviewed some of very old women who went to the Achimota school, and then those people I met are married to Achimota graduate. So, you know, that's how the project of, educating the leaders' wives worked in Achimota very successfully. So those women, they say that they looked at the British teachers. Most of them came in a couple. Many of them came in a couple. So they look at the domestic interactions of teachers, husband and wife, and how well educated the cultured people would manage the household, and how they are going to support well educated husband, and how they are going to grow their children. What kind of education should be provided for their children? What kind of food should be eaten at home? All kinds of things they learned from watching teachers in Achimota schools. And also they interacted with other students who also internalized the value of that kind of wives of highly educated, highly westernized husbands. So in that sense, women who went to those the Achimota at a very early age became the partner of the newly independent Ghana's leaders in industry, in the medicine, in political scenes, all different kinds of fields had graduates of Achimota School. And most of them, many of them had the wives who also went to Achimota School.
But of course we have, the unintended consequences. Mm-hmm. Right, of Achimota. And I think that's really some of the most interesting work that you can do with the interviews that you've engaged in. And one of them is really the intense social mobility that Achimota offers in the beginning, mm-hmm. in its early years. You say that there's, two-fifths, 40% or so of students are on scholarship. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about the composition of the students in the 1930s and how that shapes the emerging culture of the school.
Oh, okay. I don't remember the exact figure, the proportion of the students on the scholarship, but because of the mission of Achimota School, the school gave scholarship not only to those children who have high test scores, but it also intentionally, it brought children of traditional chiefs or the people in the countryside. So the population, student population in Achimota had a lot of people from north, from east, from west, very widely captured from different parts of the country. And they came, when they came, they were not exposed to any Western culture. Some of them have never seen the piped water or the electricity, so the experience in Achimota was the first exposure to the Western culture and anything Western and anything development. So, but once they come there, then they develop their own, community. They develop their own, society of future leaders. So the social mobility, I think it's not only in the case of Achimota, but in many society which have the relatively shorter history of school-based education in many former colonies. The school was established as a channel to get the employment in the Western companies or the colonial offices. So then those people who went to those schools are promoted very quickly compared to those people who stay in the traditional life. So then this new group of people who got the chance of getting cash income and getting employment in the Western community and speaking English or French, they would shape the new group of new leaders who is going to dominate many benefits and many opportunities. So the first generation who had the chance of going to Achimota or who had the chance of going to the secondary school in any colonies, they tend to have a very dramatic social mobility. They come from countryside, they didn't have any opportunity, but because of lack of opportunity, they chose to come to the school. So then by choosing to come to school, they were promoted. They got the huge opportunities in the transition period between the colony and independence. And then, so that social mobility was very dramatic in the first generation, but then the second generation after that, that is another, the flip side of the education function. One generation is going to benefit from the social mobility, but the second generation is going to reproduce that benefit within their own circle. So that is going to sustain the same group of people to be in a prestigious position. And that may have some negative effect on the dynamics of the independent government after some decades. But anyway, coming back to the Achimota's effect on social mobility, that was dramatic. Those people who came from countryside came from nowhere would have the chance of going to Britain for higher education and getting the distinct in when they graduate, and then they may get a very high position in other part of the British Empire. So that kind of things happened because of the social mobility created by Achimota.
Well, since you touched on it, maybe we can begin thinking about what are the longer term legacies of this period, the 20s and 30s, that you looked at, because you have such extensive experience in the present day and in the policy space more recently. So what do you see as those continuities?
I think, for example, one of, let me first talk about my own consistent research interest. I started to look at the discourse on colonial education for my dissertation. And then after that, I was, you know, after like some 5 years or so from my dissertation, I have written something about the adaptation of education for all movement to the national education policies in some African countries. And then in 2015, I have also published another book, which was about the discourse on the sustainable development goal and education. So my continuous focus of research is how those dynamics among the actors with different intentions, motivations to converge on certain international agenda or some influential documents which determine the nature of the policies and practices of education in the, in Africa particularly. Then by continuing that kind of discourse analysis of policy making at the global level, my sense is that the structure of negotiation and structure of simultaneously determining the contents of policies in different parts of the world, that structure has started in the colonial period. So the if you look at the you know, today's United Nations or the World Bank's prescriptions given to the developing countries, you know, that kind of prescription is based on the consensus building done at a very high global, you know, level. And that kind of negotiation at the high level has nothing to do with the realities people face in daily educational practice or life. But still, that kind of high level negotiation determines what kind of policy focus is going to be you know, promoted. And sometimes it is striking to see how the line of logic you see in one country's policy document is quite similar to the logic of the policy documents in other country. And then the programs of implementation seems to be quite predictable if you know about one country's policy making, because that there is a kind of overarching framework which is agreed at a very high level, far away from national policy making, far away from people's daily lives. Still, the policy tone is set at a very high level. So that kind of structure persists, and I think that is a kind of, you know, it's not problem. I may not have the right words to explain about it, but something we have to turn around now. Because they, if we look at the situation nowadays, the United Nations mechanism doesn't always work fine. There are, you know, if you look at the situation in Ukraine, for example, the United Nations cannot control anything. Russians, there is no sanction, there is no, you know, unanimous decision to be agreed in the United Nations conference room. But still, we maintain that system of United Nations. And when was that system established? It started in the colonial period. And post-colonial United Nations system or all kinds of mechanism actually started to take shape during the colonial time. So by looking at the history I have the kind of reference point to critically observe what is happening today. I can say that the discourse which we are looking at today is fundamentally unchanged from the time when the colonial education was discussed. And if we really want to think of the changes in a more authentic manner, probably we should question this whole structure, which has persisted for such a long time.
I couldn't agree more, Shoko. You put it so, so well. Let's maybe begin wrapping up and a kind of traditional final question here at the New Books Network is to ask you what you are working on right now, what projects you have ongoing.
Okay. Well, actually, I have different projects, and I'm not sure I can be good enough to explain all of them in a coherent manner. But in along the line of what I have discussed today, probably I would say that what I am interested in is the construction of knowledge from the people's perspective, I would say. What I mean is that when I start, I talk of education, I don't want to talk of education as the issue of curriculum or efficiency of curriculum teaching and the test scores. Those things are important, of course, but what I want to establish as an academic analysis is to untangle how people link the knowledge from here and there, and then construct the set of knowledge which works for him or her. And so that's why one of my research projects I am doing now is to evaluate or assess the skills of people who are working in the industry. The reason why I'm doing that assessment is not necessarily to count the amount of knowledge they have, but rather what kind of combination of knowledge would be considered useful by the people themselves, and how that is accepted in the society surrounding them. So that one of the project I'm doing is to capture the package of knowledge which people develop by themselves. And at the very bottom, I have the same interest where I'm doing another project, which is to investigate the meaning of sustainability in the local traditional knowledge system. So I'm trying to collect, the sustainable development is such a fashionable word, and nowadays everybody talks about the sustainability, but I want to collect the notion of sustainability in a more localized and historically rooted manner in African, like the stories told by the grandma or the ethnic groups historians. They have a lot of stories to tell. So I want to dig into these stories which have lived in together with people, and try to find what would sustainability mean, and why people try to, how the meaning of sustainability would make sense in people's traditional life. Probably the logic would be very different, but in the traditional community, people lived with each other, and the difference between human and animals and the ancestors, these differences were not so clearly distinguished, but still they talked of the coexistence and utilization of resources in a more collaborative or coexistent manner. So I want to find this knowledge about sustainability in people's life. So there, you know, two different projects I just mentioned, assessment of knowledge of workers and the collection of stories of the sustainability in the local community. Both of them may look very different, but at the very bottom, I want to reconstruct the meaning of knowledge for the life of people. And that project is going to give us the other perspective to look at practice of schooling and practice of education and practice of international development.
Fantastic, Shoko. I really wish you all the best in this really important work that you're doing.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for talking with us today about this book, and I hope that we will continue the conversation.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.